is Icon Art Radio with Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby.
Well, I'm going to jump in here with a quote from Cézanne. We got very wordy in our last show and pretty abstract, and we were kind of talking about philosophy versus action and so forth. So I thought this quote from Cézanne was relevant and could spark us today. He said, "Conversations about art are almost always useless. Work, which brings about progress in one's art, is sufficient consolation for being misunderstood by fools."
Well, thank you all for listening. This concludes the Icon Art Radio series. We will no longer be talking about art. Now we're going to play some rock and roll. Of course, what we also could say is that this radio show, for example, is in fact, in its own terms, a minor work of art, struggling to be a minor work of art. And so talking about art can be an art.
Right. And also listening to quotes from other artists doesn't mean that we have to believe everything they said either.
Oh, that's true too, right? Cézanne, who believes
it? But they can just spark us to think for ourselves on this topic. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's Cézanne. What would you expect him to say? That's Cézanne. He's nothing but a cut-up.
Well, at the risk of taking this show into the territory we went into the last 2 weeks,
no way.
Let's keep it down at the level of the artist around
the canvas.
The cafe table.
Yes.
His something or other.
Oh, no. I
artists
no
can sit. I mean, we can talk the thing to death. We can talk until we can't do it.
And I think anyone who doubts that should just simply replay the last two shows 4 or 5 times. And anytime they feel a need to go there, just listen to them again, especially the last one.
Well, it's a
good manifestation of what Cézanne is saying, that really, you know, there's no point in trying to analyze everything and then do something about it. You got to get back to the Nike commercial and just do it.
Well, and then Barnett Newman said that aesthetics is as important to the life of the artist as the study of ornithology is to the birds.
Yes.
The birds sing and fly,
right.
And they are untouched by ornithology.
Right.
Sorry, my throat just...
That's all right. We were just having a moment of much-needed silence.
Because it's a way easier to talk about anything than to do it. And you can kill the action by talking too much about it. I realize this with my novel.
Uh-oh.
That if I sit...
we're saying it again.
If people ask me about my novel, the more I talk about it and the more I tell the story to people, it's almost the less I feel like I have to actually write it.
Yeah, yeah. It's like when you take somebody's picture, you steal their soul.
Well, first of all, we all know that everybody has ideas and can talk about so many wonderful, you know, castles in the air that they could build. But actually driving spirit into matter, driving a cognition or an idea into matter, is just a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And yet it's in that work that the artist is nourished. And I think this is the point that Cézanne's making, that it's in the work that the artist gets his reward.
Yeah.
That mm-hmm. every step of the way is a discovery of truth in the context of his work, and that there are no other rewards in the thing. So you don't care what anybody thinks, because what you're doing is what you're doing, and it's getting somewhere, and you know where it's getting.
Yeah.
And it's going to be misunderstood. This is what somebody pointed out to me, a dear friend pointed out to me one time, because I was a kind of clarity addict. I always needed to explain what I was doing and why I was doing it to everybody so that they would understand and, you know, I guess approve of what I was doing. And people who would misunderstand, it just made me feel like, oh, I didn't explain it clearly enough. I have to explain it more clearly in more detail. And then I would wind up getting like terribly frustrated because they still weren't, quote, getting it. And then this friend very sweetly, kindly actually pointed out to me, Donna, somebody is going to misunderstand anything you do because people think differently about things and their orientation towards life is different and you just have to accept that. And at first I kind of got mad and said, well, gee, that's not fair, until I realized it wasn't necessarily a bad thing and that I really wasn't giving people credit for being unique individuals if I expected them to understand in my way everything I was doing.
Well, also, you know, we have this notion that communicating means that we sort of work on something for a while and create a thing, and then we shove the thing into somebody else's, you know, sensory apparatus, and they respond to the thing and have a thought. So you have a thought, and then words come out, and the words go into me, and I have the same thought you had. And that's got nothing to do with the way communication works at all. You know, what really happens is that there's movement of consciousness in your apparent individuality, and then some words are spoken, and then in my individuality, some thoughts arise. And they're not the thoughts that arose in your mind. You're not like giving me your thoughts. You just said something and had an effect on me in my environment. And then I had thoughts. And the idea that they would correspond at all is a little bit far-fetched. And then to think that, you know, you can really pin them down and narrow it down and get a good definition of everything, make sure there are no misunderstandings, is so utterly hopeless and unrealistic that, you know, it's more ridiculous than anything else. And yet we all operate kind of on that assumption that when I talk, I save my thoughts and you hear them and then you know what my thoughts are. And it's just not true.
Well, I think last week you were talking about the dilemma that would paralyze you in terms of action. I think this dilemma was my paralyzing dilemma, the one where I felt like I couldn't really be friends with somebody unless we understood each other deeply. And what I wanted more than, you know, people would say, mostly I just want to be loved. And I would say, not me, mostly I want to be understood. Because that was sort of the bottom line level that never seemed to actually happen and that I really deeply wanted to happen. And it took letting go of that and realizing that that really wasn't the essential of life.
Yeah.
I don't know where along the line I got convinced that it was the essential of life. Maybe it was a discomfort as a child at really feeling on some deep level that I was different from other people, you know, that I was an oddball of some sort. And I felt that I either had to, that my choice that faced me was I either had to willingly be like them and give up my oddballness, or I had to somehow explain to them why I was that kind of an oddball and justify it in some way so that they would.
Yeah, this justifying thing is a common problem.
So we're looking for that one friend that would get it. Communicate to.
And I didn't realize that I could actually be really good friends with people who are totally different from me and that was going to be okay with them.
Yeah.
And well, as a youth, I had this misunderstanding that we all saw things the same.
So when I thought
I was explaining something to someone, I was expecting this thing that you were describing that can't really happen to happen, that they were actually cognizing exactly what I was experiencing and what I talked about. And that I soon enough found that wasn't the case. But it was quite an awakening, and I went a number of years, more than one would think, with that erroneous understanding. And my family didn't help, because my family had this thing of that we needed to all agree on things. If everybody in the family didn't kind of agree on certain what was right and wrong, then something was all amiss and wrong. So if there was that, when so I had this sort of, you know, consensus sort of thing going, and so I carried into life the idea that there needed to be a total consensus. But that didn't work too, because there seemed to be two sides, like the Republicans and the Democrats, and there was always like the people that didn't agree with. So you were always setting yourself up as an enemy against the opposite,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So you had at least half the people could be in consensus with you, but left the other half that was your enemy.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the major, you know, pillars of my quarter century relationship with Mary was our mutual understanding of the fact that we were totally different. We were just so different that it was ridiculous. And we figured if you love someone that different and respect them and it's mutual, then you gotta just be setting yourself up to learn a whole lot of really wonderful stuff. And we did. You know, it was based on the difference rather than the similarity. She didn't know what I was talking about when I got into this sort of, you know, wild abstract stuff. But there was stuff she talked about with the same kind of effectiveness that I knew I didn't know what she was talking about. And I thought, wow, I wonder what it is. There's something there, you know. She gets through life. She doesn't drive her car into a tree every time she goes on the road. And how can that be, you know, when she doesn't understand this thing that I was explaining so beautifully? And after a few years, you know, we both learned, you know, the answer to that, which is that it's not on those levels, not in those terms.
And if the art world functioned more on that level, mm-hmm. it would be a much nicer world, you know, because I think what Cézanne was saying, another thing he was saying in that quote was, you don't have to justify your direction that you were, you know, when you're pursuing something in your studio, you don't have to explain to other people why you're doing it that way. You don't have to defend it against the art critics or the art authorities or whatever. It's the progress, the daily progress that you're making with your own creativity that counts.
Yeah.
And that's why Calder didn't call what he did art, so he didn't have to justify
that's
it
right.
as art.
Just
it was just what he did.
Yeah.
And it ranged from pulling a bunch of wire out of his pocket at a party and making a toy, to making a toy circus, to making monumental sculpture that rivaled, if not exceeded, the work of the other great masters of the time who were really making art.
Yeah.
And then when we watch these movies of the artists and hear them talking about their work, it's always a remarkable thing to me how most of them use very few words and seem to have a difficult time even making like a whole sentence to talk about a particular work of art, because it isn't about that. It's not about an explanation and a meaning. And I think that's, and somehow the pearls of words that come out in these attempts to communicate to some degree to somebody who's watching a film what they're doing, they take you on this ride, like you were talking about before, where it's not information that creates communication. It's something different. It's something that in those few words that this person is saying, that if you were to repeat to somebody later, they would go, what? Well, what does that mean? That's hardly anything.
Yeah, or that's not what you said.
But somehow, in when you're watching this film and you're seeing this work of art and they're saying these few words, you do get it. You get something much deeper than...
Well, and I think this is the key to successful communication. And I think this is what art's all about. A successful work of art somehow transfers knowledge. Now, knowledge uses... Well, somehow, knowledge moves, as you've described, from one person to another via a vehicle, which is a work of art. And it seems to be a way that this can happen through this thing called the work of art, as opposed to people trying to explain to each other verbally everything is going on with them and having the other person get it. The work of art is sort of like a seed of knowledge that somehow, or a vehicle, or
well, yeah. I mean, in when I approach creating something in the context of art, my attention is not on how what I'm going to get happening in the mind of the viewer. I think about that a little bit, but mostly I think about how I can get as much as possible of what's in my awareness into the work.
Right. Exactly.
And then people will come and they'll see whatever they see. You know, I mean, there was a fellow who came to look at the monorail movie, which was 4 minutes long. And he talked to me a little bit before he went up to look at the movie. And he was a little interested in what it was. And he was trying to figure out why I had built this monorail. And of course, why I built the monorail was for fun. Was it really the only reason I built it? I was allowed to, and it was fun. And I thought it'd be cool to see this thing rolling around. So I told him the reason I built it was for fun. And he was a little perplexed by that. And I said, well, you should go look at the movie. You know, the movie's even more fun. And so he went upstairs, and he happened to go up into the movie theater while it was playing a 15-second segment where the camera's looking at the wall right in front of it. And it's just these blurry shadows moving by very slowly at the bottom. And he stayed for 14 seconds. And then he came back down scratching his head. And he told me, that's got to be about the most boring movie anyone has ever made. And I thought, yeah, you missed it. You know, so I said, it's too bad you didn't stick around a little longer. The best part was just about to happen, where it falls off onto the floor and smashes. And which, you know, usually this would be like a roar of laughter from the theater every time that segment went by. But, you know, it's just like, hey, I missed it. I wanted him to see it, just like I wanted everyone to see it. And he walked in there and he saw nothing.
But he wasn't open to receive the gift you had to give, so there was no communication.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't. I mean, he was a little bit open. He opened the door, peeked in, saw nothing,
well,
and shut it again.
Yeah, but that's like the guy that comes in the art gallery, walks around, and leaves quickly, and then makes some pronouncement about it. And here's somebody's entire life of that's available to him. And it's only trying to be given to him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I want to go back to this.
But he wasn't in my attention when I built it. I wasn't thinking,
I want to go back
to reach these
people. I
want
to go back to where you were saying it's the process of trying to drive into some material form what you're cognizing or feeling or experiencing. Yeah. And I think that is exactly what it's all about.
Yeah.
But I find that this process, if the viewer comes to look at this thing
then
with an open heart and an open mind, that he can get a deeper, that you can have a deeper level of communication through this process more than almost any other attempts at trying to talk or communicate to each other.
Well, and then I want to bring words into this too in a different context, because as a writer, all of these things still apply, even though what you're using words in a different way, so that what you're communicating to people in a good piece of writing has more to do with the imagery you choose and the flavor and the, you know, things that are not there in those exact words, but things that are sort of pointed to by those words or brought alive by. So poetry, of course, does this more than any other kind of writing, but really I think any kind of writing does this. It goes beyond this level of explanatory or analytical.
No, it's exactly what we were saying, but the physical manifestation that you have driven your experience into are words.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And collections of words and sentences.
I always think of poetry as a great analogy to the gallery, because a novel it's really more like a movie. I mean, it's a large thing, whereas a poem, you know, you're taking a handful of little chunks of words, little groups of words, and taking them way, way, way out of their ordinary realm and just putting them together on a blank page all by themselves. And to me, that's a lot like taking a picture out of a painter's studio, which may be splattered with paint from ceiling to floor and have hundreds of things leaning up against the wall in all directions, and you take that one out and you put it on a white wall with nothing near it, and then when you see it, you look differently because of that environment. And it's the same with a poem. You know, when you're reading the words, you're not just going to read them over as quickly as possible to get to the end and find out what was being said. You're actually going to have to savor them and, you know, swish them around in your mouth a little bit before swallowing.
Which is why those old academic art galleries that they, yeah, you know, the Salon in Paris, where they tried to cram as many pictures as possible, yeah, on one wall, yeah, it's like a completely different experience. And also, I think the relationship to one painting, from one painting to another painting in the gallery, also has something to do with your experience and why it's so thrilling to see these shows that travel around, you know, to different galleries where they've gone through to all the collectors and different museums and gathered together an artist's work that relates to, like Monet's series paintings, for example, and putting them all together in one room so that you can see in a row all of the haystacks and, yeah, all of the cathedrals and all that and how they related to each other.
Well, I'd like to draw our audience's attention to the Jim Shrosbury show at Icon Gallery on the Square, because to me this is where the art in the gallery comes right back full circle to the poem. I mean, these are poems that are on the wall. They're not sculptures. I mean, in a loose sense, they're sculptures, but they function in that same way that a poem takes a very sparse collection of words and makes it into something much greater than you could get by writing about it for 30 pages. And it's that same way of taking shapes and forms, yeah, and relationships and making you see them in a completely new way.
And I would suggest too to our listeners that you not only go and see the show during an art walk night, but,
yeah,
also come to,
yeah,
the gallery on
important.
A weekday afternoon. Was it Tuesday through,
yeah,
Saturday?
Yeah, actually this show will be open Monday through Saturday because
Monday.
Of our publishing goof.
Oh, well, anyway,
our postcards and posters say Monday, and we actually have someone that'll be there. So Monday through
Saturday.
So Monday through
Saturday, come to the
noon
gallery.
Noon to four, through October 20th.
And yes, see the show with nobody else or very few people in the gallery space, because you get a different
relationship around
to it.
Each piece, yeah, affects the space dramatically. There's a lot of space between them. It is like a small poem. Like,
yeah,
pages with a,
yeah,
small poem on them.
Yeah.
And I think poetry is a great comparison to this work. Mm-hmm. And how much time we've got. I feel that shapes and colors and forms have a meaning.
Mm-hmm.
They mean that. What that,
mm-hmm,
shape is, that's its meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Just like a line of notes in one key and a line of notes in another key. A relationship of two notes in music, the relationship of two words in poetry, create a meaning that's structured. There's one word has a certain meaning by itself, and then two words together have another meaning. And this is a level in which this work is produced, that it's saying things that are way non-verbal, just as poetry says things that are way non-verbal, like expository prose, and yet these combinations create a song that has a definite meaning, an interior meaning for each of us.
Even mathematics does that.
Remember, mathematics is exactly,
you know, speaking,
in fact, the whole story can be told.
This woman who was in love with mathematics, and it was so beautiful, her explanation of what each number represented on some cosmic level and how their combination in various ways created life, basically. And these were symbols that, it was just astonishing to me. It made me want to be a mathematician until I, you know, 2 minutes later realized, nah, I don't want to spend years studying this. But it was a great place to go with in my imagination and just seeing that world.
Well, I'm not sure if this program is airing before or after the next art walk, but I would just like to reiterate what Donna said a minute ago, that, you know, visiting Icon Gallery during art walk is always exciting because there's so many people there, and it's like meeting a cross-section of the whole community. But possibly it's even more important to visit the gallery after art walk and have a chance to just take your time and walk through without crowds. And I think that's especially true with this exhibit because it's a statement that needs to be savored and experienced gently and easily and over a period of time. And if you've been to the show and you don't understand what he's doing or you don't have a feel for what he's doing, I would suggest just go back and spend a little more time looking at it.
Oh, and don't bring expectations.
Yeah, don't go looking for, you know, sculptures of things. Go looking for an experience that may use sculpture more than something else.
And that's particularly true of this show.
Yeah.
However, I always look for the people that do come back, because those are the true art lovers. Those are the people. If you really love art, you won't be able to stay away from these experiences.
Yeah.
And so I'm always I'm encouraging people to fall in love with art, spend more time in our gallery and also in the great galleries of the world. We have one just in Chicago. We have good masterworks nearby in other cities too. But go and place yourself in front of the work of a master, and it will transform you. But you have to give it some time and attention.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.